Here are the rules for your exam for dealing with the dying. If you're from a culture outside the United States, or even some parts of the United States, these rules might seem different than what you have been taught, but these are what will give you the right answer on the Step 1 exam. Number one, tell the patient everything. If you know, the patient should know, period. The patient says, doctor, am I going to die? If they are, what's your answer? Yes. Yes. In fact, I'm going to fault you because they shouldn't have had to ask. You should have told them before they ask. Do not give false hope. This is oh so difficult. You really want to be able to say to the patient, well, you're terminal, we think you're going to die, but there's this other treatment I read about over in Holland that we're going to bring over and try. No, no, don't. If there is, go ahead and bring it over, but don't talk to them like this is going to save them. Because what's the patient's first reaction to their impending death? Denial. Giving false hope simply fosters that denial. Allow the person to talk about their feelings. Sure, the patient wants to talk about it. This is an important event in their life, their death. They want to talk about it. Yet often we find in medical settings, the doctors and nurses will tell us, I don't talk to the patient about their death because they just don't want to talk about it. What defense mechanism is this? What defense mechanism is this as the doctors and nurses saying the patient just doesn't want to talk about it? Well, it's projection, of course. The doctors and nurses don't want to talk about it, and so they project that and say the patient doesn't want to talk about it. The patient does want to talk about it. You're supposed to spend the time. Keep the patient involved in activities. Avoid social isolation. Of course, they're not dead yet. Children have a different conception of the world and of life than adults do, so it should not be surprising to you that children have a different conception of death and illness. Children don't live in the same world that we do. As Piaget reminds us, children represent the world to themselves differently than the adult representation of the world. Many children see illness, see events that happen to them that are bad as some sort of punishment. The parents or some malevolent force is punishing them for something they did wrong. You should be clear that prior to age 5, children have no conception of what death means. A 3-year-old girl is told by the physician, I'm sorry, but your father has died. The 3-year-old girl is as likely as not to say back to him, ooh, that sounds terrible, I'll talk to him about it when he comes home for dinner. She doesn't get it. She's not stupid. She just can't grasp this abstract concept of death. Children do understand what death is after about age 5 or 6, but they don't understand that death is permanent until about age 8 or 9. Prior to that, they think if they're extra good, if they don't step on the cracks on the sidewalk, if they say their prayers just the right way, that person will come back and be with them again. You don't realize death is permanent until about age 8 or 9. Some years ago, we had a little Cuban boy washed up on the shores of Florida, a guy named Elian Gonzalez. 6-year-old boy tried to cross from Cuba to Florida. His mother and all the people in the boat with him died. Elian Gonzalez, when interviewed, was convinced that his mother was still alive someplace, that she was going to come back to him if he was just a good little boy. This is because of the trauma of the crossing and the trauma of losing his mother, right? Wrong. This is a perfectly normal response for a 6-year-old boy. He thinks she's coming back because that's the way they see death at this age. Let's talk about the elderly and aging. Let's talk about how people are in the world when they get over age 65. The elderly are a very important part of the exam for you. If you ever sat in the office of a primary care physician, you can see why, because a large number of the patients you will face are elderly patients. The exam features questions repeatedly. We want you to understand what life is like for elderly patients. Here are the details. Right now, the elderly comprise about, 16-17% of the population. By the year 2030, that's going to rise to about 22-24% of the population is our estimate. Now, is this good or bad? the number of elderly rising. Well, it's good, right? Because it means people are living longer and longer than ever before. In fact, the fastest growing part of the population is people over age 85. People are living longer and longer. Well, there is one downside. See, right now, at about 16-17% of the population, the elderly comprise over one-third of all healthcare expenditures. That means as the proportion of the population that's elderly rises, what we will spend for healthcare will go up disproportionately. If you've heard in the press and the media about the so-called crisis in American healthcare, this is the crisis. The crisis is that as we get more and more elderly, we're going to have to pay more and more for healthcare, and frankly, we just don't have the money. 70% of men over age 75 are married, but only 22% of women. How come? Well, easy. Because men die first. If a man is alive, he's likely to have his spouse alive. If the woman over age 65 is alive, she's much less likely to have her husband alive. Therefore, much less likely to have that partner. True or false? The elderly are disproportionately poor compared to the rest of the population. They're more likely to be below the poverty line. That's actually false. If anything, the elderly are slightly less likely to be poor and below the poverty line. Over the last 20-25 years, there's been a great increase in programs that give money and benefits to the elderly, and frankly, a corresponding decrease in programs that give money and benefits to children. Why? Well, simple. It's a democracy. Elderly people vote, children don't. So you give all the resources to the people that are going to do the voting for you. True or false? Most elderly have some initial signs of dementia. Well, that's false. Over age 65, only 5 or 10% of the elderly have some clear signs of dementia. Well, over age 85, most elderly have some signs of dementia, right? No, once again, that's false. You only find about 25% of people over age 85 have some signs that you would detect for dementia. The underlying message here is clear, and I'll try to make it explicit. Do not diagnose dementia on this exam purely based on age. You're going to get it wrong. Come on, we know what you're doing. We know you're reading that long clinical question. The first line it says a 95-year-old woman. You think, I don't want to read the whole case. You hop down, you pick dementia. Don't do it. Pick dementia only if it satisfies full criterion for dementia. You should know the elderly have lower incidence of all psychiatric disorders. I said lower incidence. Who's more likely to become depressed when hospitalized? A 22-year-old woman or an 84-year-old woman? Well, the 22-year-old woman, by a considerable degree. It's about a 4-to-1 ratio. It's not even close. More difficulty with psychiatric issues in younger people. You should know the elderly are in general not isolated and lonely. Now, they may not have everything they want out of life. They may not feel like they get the respect that they want to have, but in general, most elderly have children, about 80% of them, and most have frequent contact with the children. During times of stress, strain, illness, the dominant support system for the elderly is their family. And by family, I don't mean the mafia family. By family, I mean their blood relatives. True or false? Most elderly have some long-term chronic condition. Well, that's true. But 85% of the elderly have some long-term chronic condition, diabetes, hypertension, etc., being more common examples. Nonetheless, when interviewed, most elderly, over half of them, say their health is excellent to very good. Even though they have this chronic condition, they still say they're doing pretty well. This next slide looks at suicide rates in the elderly and shows you suicide rates separated out for men and women separately. What you can see is that as men age, go over age 65, the suicide rate increases by about 10 per 100,000 for every additional decade of life. For women, the suicide rate remains roughly constant, does not change as they age. True or false? As men age, the chance of suicide increases. True. True or false? As women age, the chance for suicide increases. That's false. Also note, the bulk of this increase in suicide for men is due to an increase in white males. A patient of yours, age 75, comes to you and expresses concern that they want to maintain their mental and physical well-being as they age. They ask your advice as to what they should do. We used to give the advice of have a hobby, stay involved, be busy. That's no longer the best answer. The best answer, supported by research, is sign them up for a formal preventive occupational therapy program. The formal program, the structure of the formal program, seems to do more to help people keep people mentally and physically fit than just the old standard advice of keep involved and keep busy. What's the best single predictor of whether somebody will end up in a nursing home? Well, it's falls. It's falls. Incontinence is clearly a problem. Wandering is also a problem, but those things are often dealt with within the outpatient, that is the home setting. It's falls that seems to be the single best predictor of who ends up in a nursing home.